Good day, everybody. Because persuasion is essentially communication, it's really hard to think of an experience or a moment or a time when you can be persuading someone that it's not communication. And it's really hard to think of a moment or an experience where you can be communicating with someone and it's not about persuading them to believe something that you are thinking right now, or to think something you're thinking, or to do something you would like them to do. Ever since you were born, you have been an excellent persuader. When you were really young, when you were 1 and 2 and 3, you were very, very good. Over the years, we lose our skills in persuasion, mostly because we become civilized, but we don't ever alternate and learn how to utilize newer tools more elegant over time. So in this program, my goal is to help you overcome no and get to yes more frequently. Now, so why do people say no in the first place? Well, the reason that the word no comes out of people's mouths is because it's an instant reaction. It's a gut reaction. And they did this or something like this before, and they determined quickly that it was a bad decision. So about 90% of all no responses or no reactions come from this kind of a background. This is called reactance or resistance. Now, pay close attention. No is an instant reaction, and it really doesn't mean anything. People aren't really thinking when they say no. They don't really know why they say no. They don't know why they do what they do in general, and especially in retrospect. In other words, when you look back and say, so why did you do that anyway? And then most people have no idea why they bought the Reese's in the checkout lane. They weren't thinking about it. They probably don't remember ever grabbing it. They simply, on impulse, placed it into the cart and put it in the thing, in the shopping cart, and then put it up onto the checkout girl's counter there to let her check it out. So the fact is that people don't know why they say no. They don't know why they do what they do. And in retrospect in particular, people's memory or understanding of why they actually did anything is very rarely of use or importance to anybody. In other words, people just don't remember or and think about how they really came to the decisions that they did, which were really impulse-driven, pretty much non-conscious. So they don't know why they do what they do. Good thing to remember as you're going on in this program, okay? Often people will perform opposite behaviors depending on the words you use in each communication you have. So in other words, when I was a kid, I had a room with my brothers, and one of the things that I would say at night, my little brother Fred, he was what we call a mismatcher or a polarizer. And I just say, hey, don't you dare turn that light off, because I'd have to get to bed to go to school the next day. The light would be off in a second. So a lot of people think that way just out of reaction and reactance. People are utterly out of rational, logical mind, conscious mind control until perhaps you walk in the door. So imagine you are enjoying a shower. All of a sudden, the water turns cold. You turn around in the shower. You quickly turn the temperature up, but it doesn't go up. Someone else in the house is using the hot water in the shower, so you turn it off instantly. So that relaxing, let's say, 15, 20-minute shower that you have has really been, I hate to say destroyed, but it really kind of has, right? I mean, when you think about it, it's like you can have 19 minutes of a really nice shower, but if it finishes up brutally cold because somebody grabbed your water, you're done. It's like, wow. And 6 months later, you still remember the episode as someone being incredibly rude, and then it was a bad shower. You absolutely don't remember the 19 minutes of relaxation. You only remember the 30 seconds at the end that forced you to get out of the shower because it got so cold. Now, the next day, you take a 5-minute shower. It feels good. It was warm and relaxing. But you remember that someone will probably start using the hot water, so you get out pretty quick, and it was a nice shower. Relaxing, if short, right? And so later that week, you remember that it was a good shower. Now, all relationships have ups and downs, of course, right? So most of the time, they're in the middle. Much of your time is spent working, cleaning the house. you're not focusing on the relationship with whoever you live with. Then you go through a period where the two of you argue or fight or bicker, and it can get terrible. It's time for a new relationship, maybe. The news is broken, arguments escalate, you knew it, and for the rest of your life you tell people that you can't believe you stuck with that relationship for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. It happens all the time. So in order to understand how to influence others, you want to understand how people make decisions, how they remember the past, how they see the future. Super important. So this is what has been missing for many years, and often persuasion makers call this a numbers game, but it really isn't. Now, just from where we are right now, you can see that people remember peak experiences. They remember the freezing cold, and they remember how things end. Also extremely important in getting to yes. And they do remember good things, but they really don't remember very many good things. So people do remember those peak experiences, particularly the bad ones. They remember how things end. When asking about your competitor, so for example, if you were in a sales situation, elicit the peak experiences and the customer's last experience. Look, they wouldn't be seeing you, whether it's a new girl or a new business offer or a new opportunity for somebody to buy something from you, they wouldn't be seeing you if they were totally happy with who they currently have or who they're currently working with. So when changing your customer's state of mind, and it is necessary to do that, you have to have him bring you to peak experiences and remember the last time he bought something that was a brilliant purchase. Okay? A brilliant purchase. Remember that. Write that down. People do not see the future clearly. They do not know how they will feel when certain events come to pass. They think that certain things will make them happy and certain things would make them devastated. Neither turns out to be the case, but both of those beliefs or memories, if you will, future memories, are very powerful in the decision-making process. People don't really realize that, but the imaginary future is pretty huge in how people are going to make decisions. And it's not really about whether or not they're making a decision for themselves that's going to turn out well. The question is, write this down, is how is this decision going to impact them based on what the people in the community think of their decision? So in other words, they're going to go out and buy a red car or a yellow car or a green car or a black car. Well, how's everybody in the community going to think about that? Is it going to make them look good or bad? Okay, what about it when they take it to the office? Is it going to make them look good or is it going to make them look bad? What about for their girlfriend or their wife? Is it going to make them think that the person is smart, or did they make a really boneheaded mistake? Those are the things that really cause people to make decisions. People really don't go and talk to anybody when they say, I've got to talk to my wife about it. They sit there and think in their head, what would my wife say? They don't really talk to their accountant or the attorney, obviously. They sit there and think, well, what would the accountant or the attorney say? And obviously, people never go consult the budget, right? Oh, you know, Bill, we got to check out the budget and see if it's in there. Believe me, if the man's in business, he knows if he has a budget or not. It's people who don't have budgets, that don't know what the budget are, that write sales scripts for poor salespeople that actually follow scripts. Obviously, every successful person in business knows precisely what their budget is. They know exactly how much money they have, and they know how much money they can spend. People just don't see the future clearly, and they don't know how they'll feel when certain events come to pass, particularly those people that are responding to them in the environment. They don't even respect these people necessarily. They simply want their approval. Write that down. You will see that all of this is crucial in communication, persuasion, and obviously your business and relationships. People experience fear because they don't know what's coming. It's ambiguous. It's all scary. It's no until you bring them out safely. Write that down. In fact, this might be some of the most important information, cognitions you've ever learned, I would think. Now, here, for example, have you ever been in a conversation with someone and then that person says, hey, why did you say that? Well, I didn't say that, right? Yes, you did. I heard you say that. I didn't say that. Now, that night, in separate conversations or even journal entries, both of you make the other person out to be an idiot or thoughtless or something else that isn't all that positive. Clearly, one of you at least, perhaps both, is incorrect, but both of you are equally certain that your memory is correct. The fact is that trying to resolve this is not possible. This is the problem of memory. The brain makes stuff up out of thin air to fill in blank spaces. Everyone experiences these moments where they said or heard or saw something that actually was not heard or seen. And you can't convince a brain otherwise because it believes it was there. Now, if you can't rely on memory, yours or theirs, what really happened, say, 60 seconds ago or 30 seconds ago, how can you possibly rely on it for accurately representing what happened in the past? Well, the answer, obviously, is that you can't. But you know this, and you've probably read Coffee with Kevin Hogan. Ah, that's the easy, and if you haven't read Coffee with Kevin Hogan, you want to subscribe, you can go to kevinhogan.com. I think if you just type in /subscribe, you'll see a chance to subscribe there as well. So anyway, you've been reading and learning about this, probably, and so the other person doesn't read Coffee with Kevin Hogan, therefore you have to either move past this point or give them a short course in neuroscience. You can start it like this. In one recent research study, people were having a very necessary colonoscopy. During the process, they were asked to report their level of discomfort at regular intervals. At the end of the process, for one group, the scope was allowed to simply not move for a minute, right before it was removed. The other group had the scopes removed a minute earlier, when the colonoscopy was actually finished, and with no additional minute of rest. Results? Well, the group who had the scope in longer but finished easier remember the colonoscopy very differently from those who had the scope in for a shorter time. The colonoscopy group that had the extra minute of no scope movement while inserted remembered the colonoscopy as not that bad. The group that had no extra moments of rest remembered it as much worse. So what's the key point here? Well, the concept is that when matched with how people actually report what they felt at each interval in the moment, not later that night in a journal, that memory entry, but what the memory was, they reflected the end of the memory and not the entire experience. See, people remember how it finished and generalize it back to the rest of the experience. So as you're communicating with people, realize that how you finish your communication is pretty huge, and it's going to determine whether they say yes or no, and whether they're going to like you, and whether they're going to want the next product or service that you put out. At each step, you want to know that the person you're talking with does not operate with a video camera in his mind. He operates on his memories, and it doesn't matter if they're accurate or not. Therefore, you need to clearly show how not acting in a way that he recalls as being painful, write this down, in the past, will have dire consequences. So what do you do? You've got to show how both decisions could play out along with the probabilities of both. Now, for people who lost money in the stock market, you can understand their interest in staying in the money market. Unfortunately, the reality is they're probably going to go broke if they do that. You simply can't tell people to ignore the past. You got to point out that it could happen again, though it's more likely that because the environment is not completely different, typical results are more likely. And the research in persuasion is pretty clear. You've got to point out both possibilities in the future for you to be successful. Otherwise, the person will be destined to go with what feels right, or how he usually experiences life, in order to make sense of what's going on in his mind and his body. The phobia of losing is tough to get past without at least acknowledging and examine those possibilities, possible outcomes. So then you finish with a very clear picture of a very likely future. And if you paint it too rosy, people aren't dumb, and they shouldn't be, and you're going to lose all the way around. So the other person will feel manipulated if you paint the perfect picture. If you paint it realistically about what's likely to happen, there's a really good chance that that person will respond appropriately. Ultimately, the stock market crashed, the Titanic sank, the Twin Towers went down, but it's not a reason to avoid the stock market, boating, or buildings forever. And in fact, having failed in the first two quarters of the game is all the more reason to try harder in the second half. And that is the message that needs to be made clear to your clients. And they will get it if you use that metaphor. Never let a bad result in your past turn your client into a non-client. One of my favorite people in the world, Dr. and Professor Eric Knowles down at the University of Arkansas, worked with a couple of other guys named Crawford and Lynn, and for 20 years probably, they've done more research into reducing resistance than anybody I know. And I've really been fortunate to be able to know Dr. Knowles and to be able to adapt his work into business situations and settings, as well as into relationship settings. They did most of their work at the research lab level, whether it was out in the public, going from door to door, or right in the labs at the U. And their work has influenced mine greatly. So reducing resistance is accomplished with what the good doctors call and coined omega strategies. Now, an omega strategy is a persuasion strategy that doesn't try to improve or enhance the value of the product, but it's solely focused on reducing reactance and resistance in the process of persuasion. To know that reciprocity is effective is one thing. To know how and when to reduce resistance is another. To know how to induce reciprocity is quite another. To know that asking for a favor can be a powerful technique of influence is different from knowing when and how to ask. Make sense? I want to show you how to communicate persuasively using a couple of separate techniques of influence, and also want to show you what not to do. So, for example, "Son, if you do that, you're going to kill yourself," said the mother. And the son went right back to doing it again. Mom neglected a key factor of influence almost everyone forgets, so write it down. You want to give specific instructions or steps when attempting to influence behavior. Simply telling someone to stop doing something or get a job or behave or shut up or buy this is utterly and completely destined to fail because these are not instructions. So the decades of research reveal that specific instructions are crucial for getting people to not only do things, but especially if you want to cause their behavior to change. Anything short of doing this is unlikely to succeed, long-term or short-term. I could detail all the research and go in-depth, but I'll save that for Coffee with Kevin Hogan. Instead, I want to bring your attention to another technique that can be remarkably influential, or it can blow up in your face, and that's fear. Now, fear is something that we're all wired to fight or flee from. Our irrational fears are those that we attempt to conquer and overcome. No one likes to experience fear. Fear can completely motivate people in ways that few other things can. It can also really mess things up. So if you say to somebody, "If you have sex without a condom, you could get AIDS," that statement could induce fear or not. It could induce a behavioral change, but I doubt it. The word AIDS now is a bit like accident. The public has been inoculated to the word through overuse and abuse. Imagine that you keep smoking the cigarettes that you've been smoking, and what you see is your kids and your grandkids coming to look at you in your casket, and they're crying because they can't speak with you anymore, they can't talk to you, they can't get a hug from you anymore. Because why? You committed a slow suicide with tobacco. Your face is shriveled, and they'll never think of you in the same way. You abandon them on purpose for cigarettes. Now, that's a scary scenario for most people with children. You've now use fear in a very powerful fashion. Let's follow it up with, and if you cut to half a pack a day, this, you know, like now, and to a cigarette each day next month, and finally throw the pack away, wouldn't it be something to see your healthy and happy grandkids seeing you happy and healthy as well, having fun playing with those grandkids? Now, what happens? We scare the heck out of our friend or our relative, and then we give them a specific set of instructions to follow. That's what's persuasive. But in the case of cigarette smokers, they may have heard it 50,000 times, in which case they are completely vaccinated or inoculated against your proposal, and they will not pay attention to your petition. Once a person has heard the same words or concepts over and over, the words become impotent. So what do you do? And by the way, is it ethical? And that's an interesting question, and books have been written about such things. Well, the answer is that if it saves lives and causes better relationships, it's probably pretty ethical. I've spent a good chunk of my life causing people to do things that they normally wouldn't do themselves. I've helped a lot of people, for example, lose weight, enormous amounts of weight that they never would have lost if we wouldn't have done some mental handiwork in their brain to cause them to do so. The same thing is true for people in business. I've done a lot to cause people to save money and to stash it away so they have a bigger and better future that's in store for them. So there's absolutely an awesome side to persuasion. Of course, there's always a negative side, but generally speaking, the lesson here is simple. If you're going to use something like fear in a communication in order to foster change or alter behavior or encourage someone to buy your product, idea, service, you got to include a step-by-step set of instructions in your message in order for it to be successful. So, what is the formula? Write it down. Negative emotions plus a behavioral plan cause behavioral change. Now, what happens when two scary or anxiety-producing experiences compete with each other for the person's behavioral response? Academic researchers have been studying anticipated regret, write that down, for the last decade maybe even, and, well, here's a scenario that was proposed to 164 UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. Boy, if you went there, how tough was that? You've parked your car in a parking lot, and you're rushing to class for an important quiz that you don't want to be late for. You realize on the way that you may have left your car unlocked. Half the students were then told to imagine how they would feel if they go back to the car, find it was locked all along, and miss the quiz. The other half of the students were then told to imagine how they would feel if they didn't go back to the car, took the quiz, only to come back to the car and discover it had been vandalized. How would they feel then? Okay, guess what happened? What do you think happened? Just think about it for a second, okay? Which half, what do you think? Okay, well, of those told to imagine the car vandalized, 69% said they would return to the car and check to see if the doors were locked. Those who were told they would miss the quiz, 34% said they'd go back and check on the car. A control group showed 46% returning to check the car. What's the lesson? In general, where the students experienced anticipated regret, anticipating they were going to feel regret, they said they would take the appropriate action to prevent the regret from happening. Now, we all know that what people say they will do and they actually do in real life are different things. Later research has in fact validated this fact. Where people experience anticipated regret, they tend to take action to prevent the regret. As people of influence, that's a pretty important thing for you and me to remember. Now, I want you to do something. I want you to write down 10 things that you can do in your business where if people don't take advantage of your product or service, in other words, if they don't take advantage of your product or service, or you, okay, maybe you're the product, maybe you're trying to capture the girl or the guy out there, okay? Well, what are the 10 things that that person, if they don't take advantage of you, in other words, buy you, have a relationship with you, what are those negative things that are going to happen to them? In other words, how can you take advantage of the concept of anticipated regret every single day with clients, customers, people, and relationships? Look, beliefs stick like super glue in the brain when you're attempting to persuade someone who believes something that runs counter to your proposal. You want your clients to buy your product or your service. They have a belief about you, your product and your service. You want to change it and have proof beyond a shadow of a doubt that their belief is perhaps wrong and that evidence you have is correct. They will not buy from you if you show them that evidence. They will not. Even if it's crystal clear proof, you're going to face an uphill, though not impossible, battle. But how uphill? You already know that people stick with political parties and religions. The reason you're not supposed to talk about them in polite conversation, right? All right, regardless of evidence to the contrary. I've been asked to help out on two presidential election campaigns. One was to elect Bob Dole for president back in 1996. I liked Bob Dole. He was basically a good guy. He was smart. He was a conservative. And I said no. And part of the reason that I said, well, the whole reason I said no, I think pretty much at the time, was that the platform of the Republican Party was that cigarettes aren't that bad for you. And I'm paraphrasing this now to keep this kind of short and tight, but how idiotic can you get? I mean, tobacco was putting big money into the Dole campaign, and I have nothing against corporates helping presidential candidates at all. They therefore were downplaying the negative effect of tobacco. That's what I was concerned about, and I wasn't interested in being associated with anything like that. And by the way, remember, I do happen to like Bob Dole very much. This was simply crossing an ethical boundary in my mind. My belief was really strong that promoting the idea that tobacco was less deadly than it would simply be wrong. I would never be able to live with myself. It took about 10 seconds, unfortunately, to make that decision. Could have been very profitable. When Hollywood called and asked me to help out in the Barack Obama campaign back in 2008, I believe. Nope, 7 it was. 2007, got the phone call, and yeah, I had to say no to them for different reasons, because of what the man stood for. But boy, I tell you, it was tempting. But only tempting because it could have been fun, but not because of the end result. And as it turned out, they didn't need the help. My belief was strong that promoting the idea that tobacco was less deadly, or that promoting someone who I couldn't even rationalize being in office, is a bad thing. Political and religious beliefs run deep because of the degree that they're defended against other people who believe otherwise. The more beliefs are defended, the more deeply entrenched they become, and as humans become emotionally intense about their beliefs, they become more difficult to overcome with logic or even outright facts that completely banish the belief from a logical mind. Logic alone rarely, really rarely, can eliminate a belief. Typically, only other beliefs can help in unseating beliefs. But what about beliefs that aren't defended as much? What if the belief isn't about being a Democrat or a Catholic or a Republican or a Jew? What if the belief has much less involvement at the emotional level? What would you test? How would you test to know that we weren't guessing about a philosophy of persuasion instead of a factual understanding? Well, you'd have to induce a belief and then try to change it. There's an interesting idea. So two groups of people were given brief descriptions and questions about a quality that makes firefighters, one of my favorite group of people, successful or not at their job. This was done back in 1980. One group was given substantial information that successful firefighters are risk-taking individuals. The other group was given substantial information supporting the idea that those who are not successful tend to be risk takers. Then the experimenters totally discredited the information he had given the participants, said it was completely false, I made it up, there's no evidence one way or the other. What happened? Well, those who were told that good firefighters are risk takers continue to believe what they had come to believe. Those who were told that good firefighters are not risk takers continue to believe what they had come to believe. There was no change. In a later study, when participants were asked why they believed what they had come to believe, their belief strengthened after they had given the causal why explanation. Cool? So participants did not explain the reason for their belief was because the experiment they took part in. In each case, it was attributed to other reasons. Many did not remember that they even received this information in an experiment. Now here's the scary news about people's beliefs from research. Two groups of people were surveyed for their beliefs, either pro or con, about capital punishment as a deterrent to the crime of murder. Then each person in the two groups was given an article. Half the people in each group got an article that revealed that, in general, murder rates dropped in states where capital punishment is made law. The other half of the people in each group were given an article that revealed that, in general, murder rates do not drop in states where capital punishment becomes law. That's it. Results? The original beliefs were substantially changed, not in the direction of the evidence they were presented, but the opposite. Those who were shown that capital punishment did not deter murder believe more strongly that it did if they believed that in the first place. Now today I'm going to show you what you need to know about the different types of beliefs, how they come to be so intensely defended, the very few strategies that work in unplugging erroneous beliefs. Many people attempt to persuade others by telling them what happened to themselves in a certain situation. I tried it, it really works. Or maybe like, they're just like you and they tried it and it worked. And these strategies have been proven to not work better than chance. So what does work when you can get clients to imagine themselves performing the target behavior that you need them to do and experiencing internally or externally that behavior in some way? So I want you to write those things down. And then I want you to go ahead and go to the next audio file.